Football is back, and it's exactly like we all remember it. Yes, this is episode 163 of the Tyler Sen podcast, but let's face it, it could have been episode 145, 150, 155. We kind of have the same recurring theme, isn't it? As we come to the 2018-19 season and start with a defeat for Reading at home and in the last minute, the most painful of defeats when it gets broadcast to the nation as the representative of the Footballing League starting again, and yet it's a 2-1 defeat to Derby for Reading. And joining me, we'll whiz through that, and then we'll talk about the transfer deadline and update you on what's happening with the periphery teams, the youth and the women's teams at Reading, and then get on to your mailbag a bit later on. But joining me to do that are two fine troubadours of the Friday night action, who I'm sure drown their sorrows in the most appropriate of ways. And beginning that is Handbags, Dave Harris. How's it going, mate?
Not too bad. You all right?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. We were planning on doing this, or I said we planned. We started recording this podcast on Sunday night. So for those who expected it a little bit earlier, sadly that wasn't the case because technology and specifically Skype got in the way of us. But sadly, what it does mean, or I say sadly, happily what it does mean, is that it does allow us to invite Johnny Williams back onto the podcast, who's available this Monday evening. How's it going, mate?
Yeah, good, thanks, mate. A bit disappointed that you said sadly and that you implied that I'm a raging alcoholic. Although I must say that Reading have driven me to drink a couple of times over the last few years.
I know that you're not. So we'll crack on and consider Derby then in the recap and have a short break, and then we'll be back for that just now.
View from the Tarhurst End. Recapping this week's Championship action.
So this was the classic case of the playing with confidence ruined with the sucker punch. I felt, guys, this was a sort of plotting it as a graph. You have where Reading started the game in the first 10 minutes, and it slowly goes down with perhaps the exception of the goal to the final whistle and the last head or kick of the game, as it were, to finish us off. Johnny, before we get into the nitty-gritty, did you feel like this was a performance above your expectations going into the season, or was it kind of below it even?
I think in terms of the context and in terms of getting to the end of a few seconds before the end of the game with a creditable draw, it's certainly above what I expected. And you have to say that for most of the game, we did defend well, like we did for most of last season under Paul Clement. The concerning thing for me is that I feel in the first half, it wasn't us playing well, it was Derby playing poorly. And it was only the fact that in the second half, Frank Lampard's Derby County, as they're now known.
Trademark.
Their esteemed new manager clearly had word with them and said, right, let's go away with that idea, let's go at them. And you can really see that from the second half, it was all Derby. And again, the concern was as soon as we scored, we just don't have that impetus or that belief to go for another. It's just sit back, invite the inevitable. And sure, you can say that perhaps at the end of the day, we didn't deserve to lose the game. But if you invite the pressure for 45 minutes, as we did, then that's almost inevitable. It's just of very, very bad luck that it came in the 94th minute. So I guess while you saw a lot more fighting spirit in the team, in a sense, like you said in the intro, not much had changed in terms of the mentality and in terms of the fresh start or the belief around the squad.
Handbags, when was the turning point in this game? Was it the goal that Reading scored to make it 1-0, or was it actually about 3 or 4 minutes later the goal that Derby scored to make it 1-1?
Oh, I think it's fairly clear it's the latter. When you take the lead in a match, you've got something to hold on to, and it's always disappointing to lose that lead, but in the manner that we lost it, with a shot that, it was well struck, but it was eminently savable. Manone, unfortunately, has this habit of, his wrists just turn to melted chocolate at times, don't they, in the most critical of moments. And it's happened again. It's probably, half a dozen times that it's happened since he's been here. That's the turning point. Yeah, I suppose you could call it a turning point. We still defended pretty well. There were a couple of, not heart and mouth moments, but where with a bit more quality, Derby probably would have carved us open. But they weren't, they didn't look as though they could carve us open at will. We defended well. We had a good solid shape. And it's disappointing to lose the game you know, in the last minute. But, you know, we almost did enough to get a draw from that game. And regardless of whether or not Derby played poorly or not, you know, we were still in the position to create the chances and exploit the quite horrific shape that Derby had in the first half in particular, and with a striker that had greater propensity to strike the ball and get shots on target. I think we would have been comfortable at half time. So I think, I mean, it was the most galling of defeats, but, you know, ultimately, I don't think it would have turned. Well, I certainly wouldn't have turned out in that manner if we'd have held on longer than we did.
Yeah, well, I do get that sense that it was a sucker punch, as I mentioned earlier on. What I want both of you, from when one of you's done, you can jump on this as well, is that we started off with a 4-4-1-1. It was Swift behind Bodvarsson, and it was a sort of high pressing game. We only held 36% of the possession. We were perhaps a little bit flaky in midfield when Derby attacked us directly in the first half, but there was a tangible difference between how we played, certainly under Stam and certainly for large periods under Clement last season, and how we played for the majority of the Derby game at least. Do you think that was a sustainable approach? Because the high pressing nature of it does demand that we, you know, run for 90 minutes, which we haven't seen the Reading side do in a long time. It also demands you're very clinical with your chances, because you're only going to get so many mistakes out of a team per game, and Bodvarsson obviously didn't take many in the first half. Is this approach sustainable, that we can keep getting better at it, and that it's actually something that will work in the long run?
I'm not sure that it will work in the long run, because, like I said, I think Frank Lampard's Derby were sent out. Do you know who they reminded me of? They reminded me of Yap Sam's Reading, very much passing it along the back, you know, looking for that opening, and inevitably making a defensive mistake and letting us in. And I think particularly the two best chances that we had, both of them came from Derby mistakes, either the centre-back passing it across blind and we got an interception, or us putting enough pressure on that we did get in on goal. So in terms of a sustainable tactic, I think you saw sort of in the second half, once Derby really upped the tempo and sort of said, right, you're not going to be able to put pressure on us because we're going to move it around quickly, then the game changed a lot. And I don't believe that sort of the makeup of the Reading team as it is at the moment has the ability to do that pressing from the front, because you've got the likes of Liam Kelly and David Myler in the centre of the midfield, who aren't necessarily the most, well, Myler's strong in a tackle, but he's not the most mobile, and Kelly is sort of, you know, undersized. He's not really a midfield general as you'd class him. And I think in terms of, you've got Barrow and Luca on the wings, both of those are obviously players who prefer to attack. They're not the Glenn Littles and Gareth McCleary's that we've seen in recent years, who are happy to sort of track back and really put in a defensive shift. So in terms of, is it sustainable? I think we've seen during Paul Clement's time here that he does like to sort of try and soak up the pressure and play on the counter-attack as well. So I think it was just sort of a product of what we were being given, in terms of the fact that Derby were generally sort of just playing it around the back until they could bypass the midfield and then obviously in the second half it completely changed.
What would you say then, Handbags? Would you say that against other teams, or against teams that play, you know, the majority of the Championship, certainly when they come to Reading aren't going to try and knock it around at the back and play that sort of style, is it going to work against teams that are a bit more direct or a bit more physical, or just generally a bit more competent on the ball than Derby were?
It's difficult to say, really, until we get sort of half a dozen games into the season. I mean, Johnny's absolutely right in that, you know, Derby were, they were almost sort of Yap Stam like. But they, you know, ultimately, they've got better players than us. They spent a lot more money than us on that particular squad. So once they started getting it together, it was fairly evident that while we were, you know, defensively reasonably sound, we weren't in an attacking sense. After the goal in particular, we were almost an attacking non-entity. I think in order to play the high pressing game, you need characters like Steve Sidwell, you need characters like Shane Long, Kevin Doyle, who are quick, mobile, strong, pacey, and literally a pest. And we don't really have that. I mean, all right, so Sam Baldock could potentially sort of carry that can a little bit. But in the midfield, I agree with Johnny. It's you're not going to get John Swift doing that. David Myler's not really mobile enough, and you know you'd expect him to be sitting back most of the time. And Liam Kelly is diminutive. So with the personnel that we've got at the moment, no, I don't think it's going to work. It remains to be seen. As I say, I think you've got to wait half a dozen games and see how it bears out, and towards the beginning to the middle of September. And if it's yielding results, then so be it. And then it's up to Clement to maintain that standard. But unless teams, the way that we played on Friday, as again, they say Johnny was absolutely right. We were reliant in some ways on Derby making mistakes. And yes, they against better sides, they would have been on the receiving end of a bit of a hammering in the first half an hour. It just remains to be seen. As it stands, I'm not convinced that we've got what it takes. I still think we're going to be in a little bit of a struggle, but at the same time, we've still created enough chances to be fairly confident. But the worry is how that second half panned out once Derby start getting together, because there are teams that are of equal quality to Derby in this division, all over the division. So it remains to be seen.
We'll have to see as well whether we go to Nottingham Forest on the weekend and how we set up for that and how we set up against teams. We could actually be talking in a few weeks' time that this was a complete one-off and that Clement had identified it in the Derby sort of pre-season games and whatnot, and he kind of knows a lot of the players there as well, having been manager. He might have just decided this is a bit of a one-off, and we'll see how Reading progress as the season goes on. As you sort of say, I'll give Paul Clement's quotes as a sort of kick-off for our final point before we move on then. Paul Clement saying that a draw was probably the fair result, but that last effort from them was from freshness from their substitute and the fatigue from us. When fatigue sets in, you make mistakes, and that one moment was the difference, but fair play to them. There were lots of encouraging things, but in game one, we've had a lesson already. If you aren't going to win or draw that game, certainly don't lose it in that manner. You do everything to make sure you do not lose that game, and that is a lesson we've learned on day one of the league. Now, my final point on this game is that Reading have been very bad at bouncing back, generally speaking, over the last 4 or 5 years, from these sort of bad moments, sort of the unforeseen bad moments, as it were, the shock defeats and whatnot, or the heavy defeats even as well. Is this the team, are we confident that this is the sort of team that can bounce back? We've brought in a lot of leaders. Much has been made about John O'Shea and Milo and Yadom, all captains when they were signed in. Handbags, is this a team that you have confidence in to bounce back from this well, or is it still, I suppose, a little bit early to say?
Well, the fact that we've actively gone out of our way to sign the leaders that you say will undoubtedly stand us in good stead. The worry for me is that two of those players, as you said, Yadom and O'Shea, yes, they may be leaders, but they've also just been captains of sides who have just been relegated. So you've got to say that at the moment, they are those two in particular, and the rest of our squad that were here last season, very much have a losing mentality. And that kind of pervades around the club a little bit at the moment, which is somewhat worrying. Exception of 16-17. You look from 2014 onwards, and even 12-13, when we were relegated from the Premier League, you can go back 7 or 8 years, and this club has a habit of ultimately of losing more than it wins. 13-14 wasn't exactly inspiring at times, and yet we still ended up on the cusp of the playoffs. But every other season around that, we've lost more than we've won. So it's a club mentality at the moment as much as a player mentality. Am I confident that we've got what it takes? Well, no, not at the moment. And I think that feeling is borne out by the history of the last 10 or so years. Remains to be seen, but history, you know, recent history doesn't exactly inspire much in the way of confidence.
Johnny, to end off this discussion and last point, what was your sort of one big positive from the game? Obviously, the result aside, it's just a fact, we are going to have games this season where we lose in the last minute. Hopefully we're going to have more where we win in the last minute than when we lose. These sort of disappointments are part and parcel over a 46-game season, no matter where you finish. What is the one positive that you take going forward from it?
I think the positive is that, you know, you've got to say we were a few seconds away from a draw with one of the sides who you would think, well, have consistently been a playoff side over the last 5 or 6 years. I think it's four of the last 6 years they've been in the playoffs, and the other times, obviously we ended their playoff dreams on the last day in one of those years that they didn't make it to the playoffs. So it's a good team, and we came very, very close to denying them a point. And I think as well, just the atmosphere around the ground as well, you could really sense that, especially for the first 60 minutes in the first half as well, when Derby were poor, but we were pretty good as well. There was just that sense of the belief, and that we could, you know, that we are better than we all thought we were, because as Handbag said, there's been such a negativity around the club for the past 3 or 4 years, excluding the playoff season under Jaap Stam. And it did feel like a new start on Friday, with, you know, under the lights, with a great atmosphere, with the players, you know, really putting in a shift and trying to say that, look, the last year and the last few years, it doesn't matter. This is a fresh start for all of us. And you know, if we come out of the game with a draw, having gone back to the wall, then we'd be having a pretty different podcast now, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the next bit of the podcast would be completely the same anyway, because as we go on into news bites, I'm going to give you a quick update on how the other Reading team's getting on, and then we'll be discussing transfer deadline day, which is coming a little earlier than usual.
Reading News Bites on the Tarlhurst End podcast.
Right, let's tick off the periphery teams, which is probably a very unfair way of calling the under-23s, under-18s, and certainly the women's team for Reading Football Club. But just to let you know what's going on with those, the under-23s kick off their Premier League 2 season versus Wolves at the Madstad on August the 11th. That's Saturday, 3 p.m. Generally, this season, they're going to be playing Friday nights and Saturday lunchtimes are the under-23s. The under-18s Premier League season starts versus Leicester away from home on the same day. And on that's on noon, and all their games are going to be on Saturday lunchtimes, pretty much generally behind closed doors. And the women, they don't start until Thursday, August 16th, away to Everton in the Conti Cup. Durham and Man United are actually in the group for that tournament, sort of pre-season tournament, before they kick on to it for real then. So, transfer deadline day. I'm so unsure, Johnny, what to expect from Reading on transfer deadline day. What positions do you think we're going to push for? Are we going to go for central midfield? Are we going to highlight maybe defence? Where do you think we're going to really be going, if anywhere, on transfer deadline day?
Well, I think it all really depends on what Mr. Liam Moore does or what he doesn't do. I think if he does leave, then we're probably going to be looking at another centre-back, because you wouldn't feel confident with McShane, Ilori, potentially Blackett and John O'Shea being your four options. Certainly beyond McShane and Ilori, I don't think you can really count on either of the last two to be reliable at this level. The position that I'd be looking for, we seem to be linked with a lot of creative midfielders at the moment, but I think we need another hustler in the midfield, really. Someone with a lot of energy, someone to play those simple, you know, the just Harry attackers, follow attacking midfielders, break up play, play simple passes, and just keep things ticking over, because I don't feel we have anyone in that mould at the moment. If we look at the likes of over the last few years, Danny Williams, who was, you know, a far bigger miss than we all thought he would be at the time. Going back, someone like Ledgetwood, who again was much maligned while he was here, but now that you look back, you think, oh, actually, he did sort of an unsung hero role. And then going back as far as, you know, the likes of James Harper as well. And I don't believe we have anyone in that side at the moment. Sort of a more mobile version of Joey Vandenberg or even David Myler. I think that is a position that we're really lacking that no one really seems to be talking about.
Yeah, well, we sold George Evans, and to be honest, I realised after we did the first podcast last week that I completely neglected to mention the fact that George Evans had gone to Derby and, of course, wasn't in the squad to face us on Friday.
Unprofessional joke.
yeah, unprofessional joke for podcast. Or is George Evans just instantly forgettable? That is the question that I want to put to you. This sense of a new centre midfielder, is it... I mean, we have Leandro Bacuna, don't we? We have John Swift and Liam Kelly, and and Rinom Hota, one of the young kids at the academy. We're kind of well stocked. We just kind of have a lot of very similar midfielders, don't we?
Yeah. I mean, we haven't really seen much of Rinom Hota, have we? But what I have seen in the League Cup games last season, he was standout midfielder on the park. George Evans going and ultimately he had quality, but he was, you know, as was pointed out by more than one person on Twitter and on the Tarlist end, he was a steady 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10 player, really, wasn't he? He never saw a standout performance from him. It was just steady sit back, keep things ticking over. I mentioned earlier Steve Sidwell, and I've mentioned over the last few years that Danny Williams had the ability to be even better than Steve Sidwell, and because they're two very, very similar midfielders. They're tenacious, they're capable of carrying the ball, capable of passing it, and weighing in with the occasional goal in every 7 or 8 matches. You know, that's the kind of character that we really miss, the type of player that we really miss in that midfield. That kind of player would have really, really helped us on Friday night and would go some way. If we're going to be playing a pressing game, we need that kind of midfielder to be tenacious and just, literally doggedly stick to running around and chasing that ball like a dog after a stick. We're well stocked in midfield, as you say. But it's all very, very similar, and we just miss that tenacity that Danny Williams recently brought to the side, and Steve Sidwell and Leisurewood, as Johnny said, players who are capable of putting the foot in and chase the ball and break other teams' play up and just be that irritating pest. We miss that.
Well, the elephant in the room as we talk about transfer deadline day is Liam Moore, who was out of the squad for Derby. And, I mean, it's such a difficult one with Liam Moore. If you take two young-ish English centre-backs that have moved in the last week from Championship to Premier League, you've got Alfie Mawson went to Fulham for £20 million. Ben Gibson went to Burnley for £15 million. £15 million is supposedly what Reading want for Liam Moore, a player who has less experience than those two and arguably has less form as well in the last few seasons. Johnny, do you think Liam Moore is going to leave? Do you think we're going to be waving him goodbye? Because I don't actually think at the moment it's guaranteed. I think it's likely that we'll see him leave, not necessarily to Brighton, but somewhere. But I don't think it's guaranteed he's going to be going.
No, it's not guaranteed. And I mean, you asked me to pick whether he will go or not, and I genuinely do not know, because it does sound as though the trail has gone cold. Brighton moved on to a Sheffield United defender and I think got rebuffed there as well. But then, I mean, as ever with the media, how much of this is just sort of agent talk and sort of, you know, trying to force things? I mean, we've seen that Liam Moore has handed in a transfer request, which obviously says that he wants to go. And in the context of, like you said, with Ben Gibson and Alfie Mawson, who are, I think, both of similar ages as well, I think Mawson might even be younger than Liam Moore. I mean, if we're asking for £15 million, there's no way that we're going to get it. If, as we've seen, we're in the financial situation we are, which is clearly not a great one. And, I mean, you know, it's tough to say on one game, but... you have to say that McShane and Ilori did cope relatively well. In fact, I actually think the arrival of Paul Clement has really been the making of Thiago Ilori. I think he's been one of the most consistent best players under Paul Clement since he came. So, you know, I wouldn't be sad to see Liam Moore leave if it were for £8-10 million. The only problem is that, like you say, the deadline is what, on Thursday. Unless we've got sort of deals ready to be signed in that eventuality, then you wouldn't want to see him go unless it were to happen on Monday or Tuesday, because you'd rather have the player than not be able to spend the money.
Well, it's been talked about. Tommy Elphick has obviously been talked about a lot as a potential replacement. He has scored tonight for Aston Villa, and I really, really don't think that we can just go and pick him off the shelf, as it's kind of been assumed for a lot of the summer.
They only have two senior centre-backs anyway. I think him and James Chester are the only two they have on the books. So,
and it looks like they have actually got a little bit of money now, Fitlow, but that doesn't make him cheaper. Exactly. Like, if you think about it, they may have to go and sign centre-backs, but that doesn't necessarily push Elphick closer to the door. So there's Courtney House. I think of Wolves as a sort of loan opportunity that we're talking about. I would hate for us to sell Liam Moore and have not bought someone permanently going into the sort of murky loan window and see who we can pick up from there. I mean, Handbags, let's consider the eventuality that Liam Moore stays. Do you welcome him back with open arms off the knowledge that he's put in a transfer request?
Well, funnily enough, there was a chap next to me in the south stand who I was talking to throughout the game on Friday night, and he asked me exactly the same thing. Now, I've seen on Twitter that many people say, no, don't bother with him anymore, burnt his bridges, blah, 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 and let him rot in the reserves, or, you know, to going into old speak there. Personally, I'd welcome him back, provided his attitude was spot on. That's the key thing for me, is what would his attitude be like if he's not, you know, if he's only 95%, 96% committed to games, if he gets any game time, you know, you can't go into a game like that. You've got to go 100%. If he's trying to preserve himself from injury or whatnot. And it'll be so blatantly obvious if he is.
Yeah.
Personally, I don't believe Liam Moore is that kind of player. I don't believe he's that kind of man. I think there are certain players that would, you know, sulk in a given situation like this. Not one of those players. I view him as a consummate professional who would give it absolutely 100%, give it the beans if he was given the opportunity to play again. So I wouldn't have any qualms in reintroducing him back into the squad if he doesn't get his move on before transfer deadline.
Yeah, well, the Tarlas then will be the place to keep abreast of all the goings-on on Thursday the 9th, which is the sort of, I suppose, random date's been picked. It's obviously the day before the Premier League kicks off, so we'll keep you all updated in there. And in terms of other sort of positions and incomings and even outgoings, there's not that much gossip going on at the moment. So Reading have gone under the radar quite a few times in this window and will continue to do so. And with that in mind, we'll move on then and kick off with your questions in the mailbag after these few seconds break.
The Tarlhurst End Podcast. By Reading fans, for Reading fans.
So I'm kind of confused, guys. We signed a striker, Sam Baldock. We'd even signed Mark McNulty earlier in the summer. And yet we've got three questions to begin with on the striking situation. Theo asking, do you think that Bodvarsson is cut out to lead the line for us? His hold-up play is decent and he took his header brilliantly against Derby, but his end product can be poor, whether that is his last pass or finishing. He probably should have scored at least two on Friday. I play him in a two with either McNulty or Baldock with him. Bilal Benassa says, I feel like we need a pacey striker who can get in behind and run the channels. Abel Hernandez of Hull is a free agent, and Bilal says that's who he'd be pressing for. And Chris Hartley says, have we added enough goals to the side with Baldock and McNulty coming into the squad? Bodvarsson works hard but is still shot shy at times. I mean, it's kind of too early to start questioning Baldock and McNulty, isn't it? We have only seen one of them off the bench, and it's obvious that Baldock probably wasn't, you know, set into the system and whatnot. We played a very specific system against Derby, probably wasn't set into that. But do you think that what we know of Baldock, could he play alongside Bodvarsson, Handbags? Is that something that you... Is that a system that would work, especially with the high-pressing game you play?
Again, not convinced it would do. You look at today's the modern parlance for formations is to play three in midfield. And it was noticeable when we took John Swift off on Friday night. We replaced him with Sam Baldock, wasn't it?
Mm.
And then we brought on Yaku Maita for Bodvarsson. So we played two up front, lost that additional deep lying forward, as it were. Went for it, and all right, we weren't exactly on top of the midfield, but we sacrificed that that midfield even more. With Myler and Kelly in there. Obviously, Myler went off later on for Bacuna, presumably because he was a red card waiting to happen at that point in time. So playing two up front, you'd have to be very, very savvy with what you do with that four-man midfield. And you've got to expect Aluko and Barrow to fill in or one of the strikers to drop if we haven't got the ball. Now, I've got no issues with Sam Baldock doing that. I'm sure he would do. Likewise, I'm sure McNulty would do that. In fact, you know, you could say the same for Bud Barson. They probably would do that, but they're not actually midfielders. And that's where the problem lies for me. So I would much rather play a midfield two that is fairly deep lying with a slightly more advanced creative midfielder, and with the three pronged attack, given license to attack at will, effectively. But at the same time, you know, you've got to expect Barrow and Aluko to, you know, whatever happens, white players, they have to track back, they have to do their defensive work. But of course, you know, we've got more, as was mentioned earlier, we had Glenn Little mentioned, and you know, thinking back to Angelo Gilkesy and Stephen Hunt, they were always willing to get their hands dirty, as it were. I mean, you don't get that impression with Barrow and Aluko. So, I mean, ultimately what it boils down to is going back to that that central midfield area again, making sure that we sign, for me it's critical, is to sign a player in the mould of Danny Williams. And perhaps then you could play him alongside, or that player alongside, David Myler, and have either Swift or Kelly slightly further forward. Then you have your lone striker, and then of course the two wide players. That would be the ultimate formation for me, and have that three pronged attack, high pressing, with the attacking midfielder sort of backing up, trying, you know, there to pick up the loose ball. That's what I'd be looking to play. Because that's ultimately, you know, you get variations of the three-man midfield in formations, but ultimately the three-man midfield is where it's at the moment. And if you don't have that, you're sacrificing it. Now, all right, we certainly don't play the Yapstan possession football anymore. We're not looking at 65% possession, you know, all around the halfway line. But at the same time, you know, you can't be expected to invite pressure by sacrificing that midfield battle. Because I don't, you know, it would be so obvious to everybody that if we play a midfield four, we'd be overrun by the better teams in the division. And, you know, we've got to be looking to push up to at least mid-table areas. And if you sacrifice that midfield area, then, you know, ultimately you're going to be losing more than you win. That's the worry for me anyway.
Yeah, I have a kind of on the same basis of the playing the two up front, as we saw Bodvarsson was the one who sort of ran around high pressing against Derby. And if you play Baldock alongside him, that means Baldock has to be deeper. It's kind of for the reasons you've just mentioned, Handbags. And my worry with that is that Reading have continually signed goal-scoring strikers and played them not in their best position, i.e. as far forward as possible. We did it with Graben, who was central defensive mid once and left wing and all over the place. And Johnny, it just seems to be pointless that if we're going to sign a goal-scoring penalty box striker, we have to stick him in the penalty box, and therefore, kind of as Handbag says, you need other players kind of taking up the slack, in the sense that you only really have 10 men at that point.
Yeah, and I think this comes back to another thing just generally about the team, is I don't think we're a team that particularly is set out to dominate a game, just in terms of quality as much as style of play. Because, being quite honest, there aren't too many teams that we are better than in in the league. And so, I never really go into many games thinking, right, we're going to dominate this, and you will be able to have someone like, going back, like a Cureton or a Lafondre, who can just sit on the shoulder of the last man, not do them with the pace, but do them with the fact that they will be in the area when they're needed. And just in terms of that as well, I think Clement is clearly setting us up for more of a counter-attacking game. And so I'm hopeful that the likes of McNulty and Baldock, who seem to be the sort of the pacier strikers who can get on the end of things and hopefully support the likes of Barrow and Luko, if they're willing to make those sprints up the line and get counter-attacks really going, then I'm hopeful that they can get the goals. But then obviously another concern stemming from the Derby game is that, sure, we defended really well against them when Derby were coming onto us, but there never seemed to be any opportunity of counter-attack. And so then, even with the pace of Barrow and the pace of Aluko and Baldock up front as well, more of a pacey striker than Bodvarsson, there never seemed to be any threat of a counter-attack. And so I think just tactically something needs to be worked on as well, because we do seem to have a lot of strikers, and we've got Barrow and Aluko, who are an obvious threat at all times, but we don't seem to be using them in the right way at the moment. If it's a case that we can soak up all this pressure and then boom, Barrow's gone and we've got a goal, then sure, then we will actually be a danger. But at the moment, it does seem as though whatever sort of combination of forwards and midfielders and wingers we put out there, teams just know that once they put us under pressure, we'll capitulate and we won't be able to get out. And sure enough, that happened on Friday night. Even straight after we scored, Clement visually said to the players, "Don't sit back now, don't sit back." And yet it just seemed to be the default setting, if you will. And so in terms of the striking options, I believe that we just need to find the right way to use them, which sounds a lot easier than it actually is, clearly. Because we know that we've got goals in the side with Baldock, and Bodvarsson can get probably 10 a season. McNulty is obviously the unknown quantity, but you hope that he can step up in time. It's just a case of learning about them. I don't think we need any more strikers, certainly.
Well, yeah, it comes into that point of the training ground and how good your manager is ultimately, and that kind of links into Sam Michael C's questions then. Seems to me that Derby only beat us with the depth of their squad, aka money, while we have no depth to our squad through lack of funds and spending. Will we ever escape this league? And I suppose it's kind of, which way are you suggesting we might be escaping the league is the point I have to that. I just think that comparing your sort of the Reading squad to Derby's, you almost, with their massive squad and the depth they have, you almost want to focus on just having a really great 11 for Reading and kind of supplementing that with younger or academy players would be one way to sort of tackle that. Sam Richards says, thought we were decent. Milo's positioning was excellent. Thiago and McShane solid. Yadom impressive. We wouldn't have the same threat going forward if we didn't have Barrow. And reports that Barrow was leaving or wanted to leave over the weekend, but Leicester have gone and signed a winger from Monaco. So I don't think that'll be, it was Leicester linked to Barrow. I don't think that'll be taking place. Robert Stevens says, do we need to go three at the back? Would enable us to get another body in centre midfield where we always seem second best, and to play Baldock or McNulty alongside Maze or Bodvarsson in attack. Handbag three at the back is something that we kind of did understand. My one problem with doing it at the moment, though, is that we just don't have the centre-backs.
Do you know what? I'm not even a fan of three at the back. And I know England played three at the back in the summer and did reasonably well. If you could remember that far back, if you could remember even further back, I know Tommy Burns was a big fan of playing three at the back. It does allow you to dominate possession, but again, the issue with it is A, you're playing, your wide players are there on their own, and it only takes, basically what Croatia did to England. They just push their wide players forward, pinning Trippier and Young back, and allowing the fullbacks the time and space in front and behind them to manoeuvre. And that's what ultimately where the game was won for Croatia. That's all it takes a team doing is, and nobody really throughout the history of the 3-5-2 or the 5-3-2, call it what you will, has ever really managed to counteract that with any degree of effectiveness. You're still able to play your three-man midfield, and you can play your two up front. And yes, as I say, it does allow you the opportunity to dominate possession, but we don't play that way now. It is a much more possession-based formation, but it's something that is so easily overcome. If not in the first few months, it might be successful for a season or so. But once teams learn how to counteract it, I think it's dead in the water. So for me, three at the back is just an absolute no-go. Not only that, of course, you mentioned about our defensive options there. You know, Tyler Blackett, Thiago Ilori, Liam Moore if he stays, and Paul McShane. I mean, yes, we've got four reasonably capable central defenders there, but you know, Paul McShane was, you know, without being overly disrespectful to the player, he's a very, very brave defender. But as a ball playing central defender, I've never been comfortable. It's like, you know, he's the white Ibrahima Sonko in so many ways. You know, would you have Ibrahima Sonko playing expansive football out from the back? No, you wouldn't. You know, and that's exactly the same as I thought with Paul McShane under Yap Stam. It was always, to be fair, he didn't make too many mistakes. But yeah, I'm not a fan of the 3-5-2, so it's a no-go for me.
Yeah, I would trust Ibrahima Sonko to clear the ball out the stadium. And in fact, I do remember one game against Leicester back in about 2004, 2005 when he did just that. Sonko.
He did. No, draw.
I don't think that's quite what Clement will be asking of him. So yeah, I mean, three at the back. I think for me, you accentuate the positions in which your players are the strongest. We don't have the strongest centre back, so that's kind of why I'm not for at the moment. Chris Hartley, his other question from the mailbag, saying he worries about Myler and that sort of defensive midfield role, and especially in the last 20 minutes, he says the team ran out of legs. What else do we need to add? I suppose we sort of covered that in the deadline day chat, and it is exactly that position we were talking about. James Spalding says, based on what you saw on Friday, would you revise your end of the season prediction? Mentally, how long do you think it will take the team to get over that defeat? And I mean, it's the second question. Once we have the answer to that, you get the answer to the first question. As soon as we know how over the next few weeks we do respond, I think then if we respond well, then my prediction for the season definitely is revised up from lower mid-table to mid-table, but certainly no higher than that. And Andy Walker to end on. Johnny, I don't know if you saw this, Paul Clement taking to Twitter, as they call it in the newspapers these days, after some criticism from Darren Bent. Darren Bent basically saying that Paul Clement's head went and he lost his mentality as his final days at Derby came on and he got sacked and everything. Paul Clement came back to it saying that Darren Bent was lazy and overweight, I think is the exact terms he used. And Andy Walker saying, what is Darren Bent's BMI? Did he eat too much crumble at Derby? And I mean, Johnny, where did you stand on this? Did you enjoy Paul Clement on his official Twitter account, of course, going and setting the record straight?
Yeah, no, I did. I really enjoyed it because I think too often these pundits get a free pass and saying whatever they like and can just, you know, managers really have no right of reply because there's an expectation now amongst managers, amongst most managers anyway, that you just have to toe the line, and players are so media trained and managers are so media trained, and they give up absolutely nothing in these press conferences these days. And so for a manager to actually make a comment that is somewhat controversial and somewhat revealing about the actual back mechanisms of a club was actually refreshing in a way, because I mean, I look at, you know, someone like, you see it far more in rugby these days, someone like Eddie Jones, who's happy to call out players and call out other managers and not really care about the consequences, because it is much more about sort of those rivalries and those you know, psyching out your opponent. Whereas it really does seem these days in most press conferences and most media that managers and players give, it's just about going through the motions and not saying anything very interesting. So for a manager to actually retort, give a justification, and you'd assume that he's telling the truth, and to actually reveal what goes on behind the scenes at a club was actually revealing, positive for me.
And who knows, maybe in about 5-6 years time, when Clement is firmly in the annals of Reading history, he might tell us something about this current season that we don't know, and that is very revealing, and tells us all we need to know to justify our position and eventual position in the table. And there was also, underneath Clement's tweet, someone posted a photo of Darren Bent when he was playing for Burton, which is his most recent club, and let's just say that Clement had a point. Is all I would notice from the stock image that was put up. So we'll brush over Forest and on Saturday night to end the show. Then obviously the Thursday sort of weekend preview show we have now with Ollie on the Tyler Stand is the full fat version of the preview, but we'll get into that next and do the predictions as well.
Get social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
at The Tarlhurst End
and facebook.com/The Tarlhurst End.
Right then, Johnny, I've got two questions for Nottingham Forest. Do we drop Vito Minoni and do we start Sam Baldock? Go.
The first one, no, not just yet. I think if you were to make a change like that, I think it's something you would do over the international break. Now, I know there's an argument to say we're not in a position where we can give up any points straight away. Certainly I'm already looking at the Bolton game the following week as a 6-pointer, which tells you about how I'm thinking about this season. But no, I don't think you can drop your number one goalkeeper on the basis of one mistake necessarily. In terms of Baldock, I almost think you have to see what he's about. I think he'll give a different element to Bodvarsson, because we know that, you know, for all that Bodvarsson runs around and puts in a good shift, he's not going to be the striker that powers us to safety. I think as long as he's up to speed, as long as he knows what the rest of the team are doing, then, you know, it is going to be a game where we're on the back foot. And I think if you've got a front three of Baldock, Barrow and Aluko, then at least you've got something to worry Forrest on the counter attack, you'd hope anyway.
Handbag, same questions for me. I mean, Benoni, if he does get dropped, I'm not going to complain. Let's put it that way. We signed Sam Walker, an experienced League One, League Two goalkeeper for a reason. Baldock, I think it's whether you want to play Bodvarsson and continue the sort of pressing game. I think he probably will stick with Bodvarsson because we're away from home. But how would you do it?
Handbags. I think with Vito, you can't drop him just yet. I mean, goalkeeping is a position which is so, I mean, every position's critical and confident, but goalkeeping in particular. And to drop him after just one game of the season, you know, every season's a clean slate as far as most people are concerned. And he'll have seen it that way. I think Clement will have seen it that way. You know, as Johnny says, you've got to give him until at least the international break, I think, and see how he responds to that error. You could see from his face he knew that, you know, he should have saved that effort. So he'll be, you know, he would have no doubt been mentally beating himself up over it over the last couple of days, perhaps. Yeah. But you know, if a manager drops him after one mistake, then I think, you know, no, that's the wrong thing to do, because it's such a confidence-based position up front. You know, to an extent, I think Bodvarsson can be if he is relegated to the bench, I think he can consider himself unlucky, because he got himself into goal-scoring positions fairly consistently over the first hour or so. He got his goal, which will give him no end of confidence. Forest will be a similar beast to what Derby were, actually. Under Karanka, they'll be, you know, fairly possession based. They'll be a strong side. They'll be a tough nut to crack. You know, Forest, Karanka sides don't exactly attack particularly fluently, shall we say. They're generally very solid at the back and don't give much away and pick teams off, you know, once, maybe twice a game. They're not historically high scorers, so I don't think it's going to be a high scoring game. But yeah, as Johnny says, we'll probably be on the back foot.
And look, and again, looking to pick teams off, or pick them off on the counter attack, and you know, with the pace of Barrow and the trickery of Aluko, you know, you could, there is an argument there for Baldock to start, you know, even maybe Mark McNulty, you know McNulty and Baldock, and I haven't seen anything of McNulty, to be brutally honest with you, but I get the impression he's a little bit like Baldock in approach. And he's a bit trickier. So you could argue that there's a case for both of them to start. But it would be harsh on Budvarsson to be dropped to the bench at the very least, I think. I don't think we will see any changes to the starting lineup from Saturday. And I think, you know, even though we relinquished control, I mean, Derby were ultimately better than us, and we've got to compete with the squad that we've got and with the best side that Clement thinks that he can play. And in that system, I think that probably is the best team that we can play. So I think we should really, based on that, I think we should be looking at going in unchanged.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if we went in unchanged, purely, as you say, second week of the season. It is a case of we've worked almost the entire summer, depending on exactly what Reading have worked on the entire summer, on one system, on one sort of setup. And, you know, we've talked on this podcast a lot for a good number of years now on a manager not knowing his best 11. And I think Clement certainly seems to have a good grip on maybe his first 8 or 9 at this stage of the season already, which is nice. But I suppose maybe that's also because there's not many alternatives floating around. Quick word on Forrest then, as Sandbags alluded to, Karanka in charge, very experienced spine with Matthew Dawson and Fox, Ben Watson and Adelaide Grediora as their centre mids, Daryl Murphy up top. There's a lot of Championship and even Premier League now in that. They've got this kind of young Portuguese attacking midfield trio at the moment of Dias, Carvalho and Goncalves, and all those are 21 years of age. So very interesting to see how they get on against us. I suppose in a sense we've got a bit of an experienced back line as well, and how that fares will be very integral to the game. My prediction then, I'm afraid, I'm going to go for Forest 1-0. Interestingly, last week, none of us went for victories for Reading. Myself, Tom Crocker, and Simeon Pickup, who is now part of the Prediction League, all went for 1-1, so we were all done over by the late goal. Dan Wimbush had 2-1 to Derby, so he's ahead with Handbags, Johnny and Westy all on a single point, and Handbags, where are you laying your 2 pence on this one then?
I'm going to go Forest 2, Reading 0.
Is it going to be a clean sweep, Johnny?
Forest 3, Reading 1.
That's a lot of goals for a Karanka team. You know, I've gone 1-0 purely on the basis that at Boa, he kind of won all his games 1-0.
I'm going for that on purely on the basis that I don't think we can defend competently.
Yeah, well, that will be quite integral to find out how this game goes. I think it's nice as well that we have the kind of the week off, as it were, before we get into it, because afterwards, of course, it gets into the nitty gritty, as it were, of the EFL Cup and all the sort of extra games going on. So it's 3 o'clock from Nottingham on the 11th, then, and then afterwards on the Tuesday night we're at home to Birmingham in the League Cup, and we go on from there with Bolton at home, Blackburn away, and Villa away. But they're all for a later day. We can rest easy, knowing that Reading have a chance for redemption even quicker than they usually need chances of redemption in this last few seasons. And away at Forest it is on Saturday. Thank you for joining us then, Handbags and Johnny.
No problem.
No worries.
And we'll be back next week. Preview show on Thursday. Reading back on Saturday evening playing at Forest. And then we'll be back on Monday with the Tyler Stand podcast. Hopefully, we'll be talking about the first win of the season. See you then. Come on, your ass.
you smile. Funny how the crowns always leave a trail, even when it's here.